Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. Today I'm sitting down with Amanda Harley, and today we're going to talk about a really important subject, which is pediatric sepsis. And so Amanda is the CNC for Pediatric Sepsis Queensland, and we are going to talk today about the role of pre-hospital recognition of sepsis, as well as what sepsis is and sort of what happens to patients when they get to the ED for the treatment and ongoing management of sepsis. So thank you so much for joining me today, Amanda. It's absolutely amazing to have you on. Now, I can't wait to pick your brain about this topic. But first, would you please be able to just give a bit more of an introduction about yourself for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm incredibly excited to be here and get to chat with you all about pediatric sepsis. It's definitely a passion of mine. I've recently completed my PhD in pediatric sepsis recognition, escalation management in ED. So hopefully I've got a few little pearls of wisdom I can share with you. But my role at the moment is I'm the statewide paediatric sepsis clinical nurse consultant for Queensland, but I'm involved with the National Commission for Healthcare and Safety around sepsis and providing some input into clinical care standards that are going to come to us in June this year, and also liaise with the Global Sepsis Alliance, and I'm on their paediatric and nursing platform for sepsis globally. So that's me in a nutshell.
That's incredible. We have the perfect person on for this episode then. So we'll jump straight into it. What is sepsis?
What is sepsis? That is a great question. So there is a few different definitions out there, but the best thing really to really define and tangibly think about sepsis is it's a dysregulated host response to infection. So that can be from any infection whatsoever. So in both adult and children populations, that may be, might be a chest infection, might be a urinary tract infection, might be meningitis, might be, what else have we got? Might be a kidney infection going on. So any infection someone has, they then get this dysregulated host response. So something is happening in the body that actually then causes damage to organs and tissues and can result in lifelong disability or death.
Realistically, for example, when I started my degree, we had things like SIRS, and then towards the end of it, we no longer use SIRS criteria as a way of recognizing sepsis, and it was a bit more general and broad. What is the sort of gold standard or process of recognizing sepsis quite early, particularly for pediatric patients?
It's another really interesting point. So for certainly in the hospital system as well, SIRS has existed for a very long time. So systemic inflammatory response to infection, which you'll see manifesting as some tachycardia, some tachypnea. Now, those things can certainly still indicate that a child may have sepsis. But the issue with SIRS, for example, is that it is not specific. The specificity is not fantastic around sepsis. And a lot of children that you'll see either in the pre-hospital environment will have a fever, will be tachycardic, maybe a little bit short of breath. Doesn't mean they've got sepsis. They might, though. And that's where it becomes quite complex. So for pediatrics, we've not had an updated definition since 2005. Whereas the adult population updated their definitions, which is what I just said earlier, a couple of years ago. So for pediatrics, we're moving towards along the similar path, which is you have to have an infection and organ dysfunction to actually be septic. But that organ dysfunction can manifest in different ways. So if you don't have in the pre-hospital environment, you won't have access to lab values. So you may see organ dysfunction, you know, displayed as, you know, extreme tachycardias, delayed capillary refills, altered levels of consciousness, which can sort of indicate some neurological organ dysfunction. But they can be really, and they're obviously, you know, hypotension, which can indicate shock, in which case a child will look really unwell, and when, then we go down to the septic shock pathway. But the ones that have septic shock are very obviously unwell, and there's no question that you will be scooping and running and taking those children to the hospital very quickly. It's those ones that are in that early phases of sepsis that are tricky to identify. And unlike the adult population, children, I mean, adults can as well, but children can deteriorate rapidly, extremely quickly. So what we may start to see is, you know, tachycardias, a little bit of tachypnea. You don't, you know, you may have a fever, but again, that's a red herring sometimes because loads of children with infection have fevers. So again, it's not really specific. But the parent may say little things like, oh, look, little Johnny is just not himself. He's been unwell before with loads of infection. You know, he's 4 years old. He's had been at kindy and daycare all his life. He's had lots of infection, but something about this illness is different. So things like that that aren't objective data, but they're certainly what the parents are telling you, are indications that you need to listen to that and try and drill down on what it is that they're concerned about. You might see a child that's a bit sleepy, and you might think, well, you know, they're 3 years old, it's probably their nap time. But the parent tells you, no, little Johnny's got, you know, is a ball of energy. He never sleeps at this time. This sort of behavior is not right for him. Even when he's sick, he's still running around. I've never seen him like this before. And they're not unconscious, which would be obvious neurological dysfunction, but they're actually not themselves and not interacting with their surroundings. So that's an indication that that's something you need to really investigate further into and think, oh, could this actually be sepsis? So no gold standard tool, no gold standard diagnostic test, no one thing that I can say be very worried about in the early phases, but it's more like the pieces of the puzzle, and that's how I like to think of it. Something in isolation, like a fast respiratory rate, you know, might not be too alarming, but then you see that they're actually tachycardic, they're not really interacting very much, and that may indicate to you, no, this is something more serious, but it also may not. So you've really got to assess the whole patient and do a full comprehensive assessment on them to pick up the pieces of the puzzle.
Absolutely. You bring up some really amazing points there, and in particular that history taking or that assessment, and the second one being the involvement of the family. In the past, we've talked about assessment of pediatrics with people such as Dr. Andrew Tagg, and he mentioned the importance of involving the family in being able to give you that expertise into what that child is actually like. As you said, you know, if little Johnny doesn't sleep at the time that you're saying, then, you know, there's something potentially going on there. And in particular, when you're talking about the history taking, you have covered a couple, but what are those sort of pertinent points of history taking or assessment?
I think the children can be tricky because depending on how irritable they are and how much they're moving around and how you know, clingy they are to mum and dad, it can be incredibly challenging to do comprehensive assessment. And I think because of that, we sometimes become a little bit complacent and we don't do a full assessment. But there's been children that have been, you know, witnessed to be okay, like they're unwell, but, you know, they might be in the hospital, but they're looking okay and responding to treatment, but then suddenly 30 minutes later they've rapidly deteriorated and something has happened. So keeping up with, at least there's two sides to this scenario, is you guys out in the pre-hospital environment can get a real baseline set of information, and you also see the child in their natural environment. So when children are in hospitals, they can certainly act a little bit differently and certainly be more scared and more frightened than when they are in their pre-hospital home normal situation. So things around heart rates, blood pressures can be challenging to get. Obviously, you've got to weigh up is it going to be an accurate blood pressure if the child's moving their arm around and thrashing about? So using techniques around trying to relax the child, you know, let them cuddle mum, try and do as much assessment as you possibly can. Obviously, rash is got a lot of hype, very, you know, with all the meningococcal era, but a rash certainly, yes, is something to be worried about, but it's also a late sign. So don't rely on seeing a rash to know if the child's got sepsis. So just to be clear, if you don't see a rash, doesn't mean the child does not have sepsis. Rashes are a late sign along with that hypotension. So signs around, you know, decreased interaction or interest with surroundings. And this is not the shocked one where they will be really lethargic and really pale and flat, their colour. So speaking again to parents around that. So it might just, you know, in the past I've said the child, I said, oh, you know, Johnny looks quite pale. And it's a bit awkward sometimes, but you've just got to ask the question, is this Johnny's normal colouring? And you don't need to say, hey, your kid's pale, are they normally this white? You can say, is this Johnny's normal colouring? You know, is he quite fair skin? So you can use words like that. And the parent might say, oh, yeah, no, that's normal for him. And you go, okay, phew, because I was really worried they looked like they had no colour in their face. So checking that, checking capillary refill. So obviously, you know, depending on the age of child, pressing down for 5 seconds, releasing, and we should see a fast capillary return. If we're not, that again is a sign that we might have some perfusion problems, and certainly can be an indicator that the child is unwell and may further deteriorate. The tachycardia we spoke of, again, rapid breathing is of concern, but also can be normal, not normal, but can, you know, increase with an infection anyway, especially if it's a chest infection. And then the other thing is obviously their interaction with surroundings, eating and drinking. And then if we think about more sinister, over time observed signs of organ dysfunction like wet nappies. So if they're toilet trained, you know, they go into the toilet as much as they normally would be, or if they're wearing nappies, have they got the same amount of wet nappies as they usually are? So of course signs like that can, and again it could just indicate some dehydration, but again it's clues together to put into your toolkit around what actually is going on with this child. How many wet nappies are they having? You know, have they been vomiting? Have they got diarrhea? Have they been around anyone else who's had an infection before recently? So again, that might indicate to you that they've had infection. The other thing is if they don't have a fever, again, don't let that lead you to a false sense of security that they don't have sepsis, because asking them, mum and dad, have you given any paracetamol and Nurofen? And some parents are really great at that. They've been through this with their kids before. They've always got fevers when they're unwell, so they're really onto the paracetamol and Nurofen. So have you given paracetamol and Nurofen? They might say, oh, yeah, we gave paracetamol an hour ago and we gave Nurofen 2 hours ago. So that might be why you're not seeing a skyrocket temperature. So, again, asking those questions. And you've got to also remember that parents won't, they're not medically trained, some of them are, but they're from the community and they don't know what they don't know, and they don't know sometimes what to tell you. So your question and history taking around that is really paramount. And a prime example with, you know, the adult populations, just to give a context here, you'll say, do you have any medical problems? And they'll say, no, not at all. No, I've got no medical problems. And then you see them put on the counter a big bag of medications and you're like, well, hang on a second, what's all this? Oh, I take this for my blood pressure. I take this to prevent strokes. I've had a heart attack, so I take this for that. And you're like, well, hang on, these are all medical. Oh, and I take some insulin. These are all medical problems. Yeah, but they're managed with medication, so I don't have them anymore. So again, our idea of what is important to ask people and really drill down on the finer details is really important. And I think I just asked, your child have they been unwell before? Yes, no. How does this illness rate to previous illnesses? And why are you concerned that you've called us is the other thing. So if they're calling the ambulance service, why are they concerned? Is this different? Might not be. That might be their first port of call. Or they might be something that they're really, really worried about that they're not sure how to articulate and need that invitation to actually give that information to you. That's a lot of information. Sorry.
No, that's great. It's fantastic. And I think, you're so right. And having to sort of tailor your questions to get the information that you need is really important. So my next question for you in regards to sepsis would be, is there any sort of groups of children that would be at a higher risk of sepsis?
So certainly the neonates are always at high risk, and that's purely it makes makes physiological sense around they don't have a matured immune system. So it's like our children who are immunocompromised, their body mounts a different sort of infection depending on what their white cells are, neutrophils, all of those fancy things. So neonates less than 3 months, certainly because they are new and fresh to the world. But then children under 5 as well is your next big risk. Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander communities, the figures off the top of my head, I want to say 8 times more at risk, but I might be making that up, but it is at increased risk anyway for having sepsis. Immunocompromised, we said. And the other thing is these children aren't more at risk that I know of, but they can be really especially sneaky, is the fit young adolescent children. So children that are playing sport and that are used to operating with, anaerobic metabolisms when they're, using oxygen demands in a different way, they can be really, really subtle and deteriorate quickly because they compensate so, so well. So be really mindful of those young boys and girls that may actually look quite well, but something's definitely not right and they're just compensating well.
That's a really important point. So now that we've gotten those patients, we've done our assessment, we've looked out for some red flags in our high-risk patients, we've got them into the ambulance and we're taking them to hospital, what are some really pertinent points that may generally be missed in a handover or that just need to really be in that handover?
I think my biggest thing would be using the appropriate language. And even if you're not sure, one of the biggest things, and again, this is not research, this is my opinion only, but actually using the language and actually ruling sepsis out. So given across the board, nurses, paramedics, students, whoever you may be, even nurses for many, many years, there is definitely a gap between people understanding what sepsis is and actually using that language. So we all think of septic shock, and that's obviously end game, really scary, critical medical emergency, but we want to get it before it gets to that point. So my big thing with the handover would be using the language. So if you're not sure if they've got sepsis, like they're looking okay, but there was something, you wanted to bring them in, there's a few red flags, be very clear in that handover to that triage nurse what it is that you're concerned about and what actually jumped out at you. Because again, hopefully after hearing this podcast, you've got a lot more knowledge about it. And you'll be able to build on that. But don't assume that the people you're handing over to have the same knowledge that you do, and they certainly haven't seen the patient in their natural environment as you have. You also may have given some treatment, right? So you may have actually given some paracetamol en route. You may have calmed the child down. They then will assess a child that isn't febrile anymore, that's looking a bit better because their temperature's settled down, they're feeling a bit more comfortable, maybe they had lots of pain. And they might think, oh, this child's fine. What's Taylor the paramedic even worried about? Why are they even here? But tell them the child that you saw and tell them how they've responded. So they've responded well to treatment. This is what we've given. We do have a concern of sepsis. This is what we would like. This is what we're thinking. We're not sure. So use the word. Tell them the intervention you've done, but tell them what it was you're concerned about or what the parent told you. Because the parent may not repeat it again. Again, they think, and again, those that don't work in health services and systems think that, all the information always gets passed across, but we know that that's not the case. So they may not tell the nurse or doctor then, oh, look, Johnny has had sepsis before. That's the other thing that will put you at risk. You know, if you've had sepsis before, you're at risk of having it again. So telling them that and telling them, mum was really concerned because usually when he's unwell, this is what happens. However, this is different. You know, he's had a period where she couldn't really wake him up as well. Or so those key red flags that you saw passed that on. And I'm just going back one second because I forgot another really key point that doesn't really get spoken about much is unexplained pain. So be wary of the child that's got unexplained pain, or certainly limb pain or pain that's not consistent with a trauma. So if they've got a sore leg and they're not walking on it, that's not normal. You know, if they've been tackled to the ground in a rugby tackle and someone trampled on their leg, different story. But if they've just got a random odd limb pain, that's of concern. And if they've got unexplained pain, it's not consistent. So they've got a global headache, for example, they've had paracetamol, they've had Nurofen, and the headache has not changed at all. Again, that's not really normal. So needs some further investigation of that.
Absolutely. That's another really good point and something that I didn't even know myself. So that's really good to take into the future. So what then is the process of that patient in ED who's now potentially on that sort of septic pathway?
So I think as well, if you guys are concerned and you've passed that on, then the triage nurse will hopefully pick up on that. So if you're in Queensland, we have a statewide paediatric sepsis pathway, which will screen a patient to assist in that early recognition patient and do all the things that you guys did, taking on board your handover as well. They'll then screen them for any things that they're concerned about. So it might just be, you might be parental concern, it might be that the child looks sick, it might be that they're a neonate and they're less than 3 months old. You'll then do a full set of obs, and then you fall down into a category that indicates any severe illness features. So if a child's got extreme tachycardia, extreme tachypnea, they, depending if you're rural, remote, or if you're in a metro area, they might do some lab testing straight away, or they might do a point of care test if you're out in regional areas. That will return a lactate level. So a lactate level above 2, we're a little bit nervous about. So once we again get to that point, if they go, yes, we've got a feature of illness that we are quite concerned about, and everywhere in the world will have this sort of handbook through your ambulance system as well. It'll just be, you know, varying criteria based on, there's no gold standard, but they'll all be around the same lines. Then a medical officer will view the patient. They'll say, you know what? Yep, this child is shocked. We need to start treatment straight away. Or I think we are dealing with sepsis here. They're not shocked. Well done. We've recognised this early. We've gotten onto it early. The paramedics have brought them in. We've had a fast triage system, but we need to start some sort of treatment. And that will be, we call it a bundle of care, a sepsis bundle. And that will be making sure oxygen saturations are of an adequate level. It'll be taking blood cultures to see if we can capture any bacteremia in the blood. It will be putting a IV in to give some intravenous antibiotics. It'll be giving a fluid bolus if clinically indicated. And then if we're going down the shock path, they'll start some inotropes. So they'll usually start adrenaline as first line. And if we're down that path, the patient will then be retrieved to a tertiary centre that has a children's quick care or a PICU, or they will be admitted to their local PICU. So that's really about hemodynamic stability, and the antibiotics are going to work against if they've got bacteria. But of course, we need to make sure that hemodynamic functioning is happening, and that is perfusion. And that's where, some fluid boluses will help alongside some vasoactive agents if they're that unwell.
That's really interesting, and particularly thinking about sort of situations where you may not be able to get a patient to a hospital as quickly as you would have liked, for example, if you're rural and remote. So I think having a sort of a broad understanding about what's going to happen in the ED for that patient is quite good to know, because if you need to be with that patient for a long time, you can consult for, you know, antibiotics if required, or, you know, further down the line, potentially, like, you know, adrenaline infusions if you had to come to that point. But just, I think, knowing what that pathway is for a patient with sepsis and potentially septic shock is quite beneficial.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the other thing is, some people may be listening to this going, oh, I've never seen, you know, depending on who's listening, oh, I've never seen pediatric sepsis before. It's quite rare. It's and I would challenge that. In you guys are in the unique position, which is a blessing and a curse, is that you drop people off at the door and you disappear, and that's it. That's all you see of that patient. But you don't know what you did that may have positively contributed to their outcome. They may also have gone on to have sepsis, and you got it in the early stages, and you brought the child in, and you did a thorough assessment, and you passed on the right information, and they did go on to have sepsis, but you just don't know about it because, you know, you don't have that continuity of care. So you probably have seen it more than you realise.
That's a really interesting point. You're right there. And that's a thing. I think not having that ability to follow up as much as you'd probably like to would probably be at a bit of you know, on the back foot when trying to treat these in the future. But regarding sort of safety netting, and so if that patient and the family don't want to go to hospital, what can you do to try and ensure that they're still going to have the best possible outcome?
And that's if they're staying at home, is it?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, so I think you're faced with a few, and again, it depends on what your local policies and procedures are to who to bring into hospital. But again, be cautious leaving children at home, because why have they called the ambulance service in the first place? You know, they are concerned for some reason. But you may also have people you go to where they just want you to assess their child, and then they're happy to stay at home. And of course, you can't force anyone to hospital. So one of the most easiest tangible things that you can do to save children's lives is to safety net around telling them about sepsis. Now, in the past, and this certainly happens in the hospital environment, people say, oh, well, we're not going to tell them about sepsis. It's going to scare them. Like, they've got pneumonia. They're fine. They don't have sepsis. Yep. But knowledge is power around this, and the community, about 24%, the last statistics in Australia showed that someone could list a sign or symptom of sepsis. Now, that's adult sepsis and children's sepsis. So children's sepsis is probably even less, I reckon, but 24% of Australians could list a sign or symptom. So if they don't know what sepsis even is, how do they know that the child that they've seen now, that the ambulance has assessed, they've said, okay, everything looks okay, and then in 6 hours' time, things change? They're not going to know that. They're just going to think, oh, well, this is just part of their unwell. If you tell them, look, I prefer you come to hospital, or, but, you know, if you want to stay home, if anything happens, if your child gets worse, there is a condition or a complication of infection called sepsis. Have you heard of it? They'll probably say, no, what's that? You can just say, you know, it's when child has an infection, and then something happens in the body that, you know, makes them really unwell and causes damages to organs. You can keep it quite simple. This can happen really quickly. It can be really hard to identify early. You know, they look okay at the moment, but that's not to say they're on that pathway. You need to come to hospital straight away. You need to either go to the ED or call us back straight away, because these are the things that we're worried about. And we've certainly got parent leaflets that we hand out in emergency departments for this. Lots of people come to EDs and did not wait, because the wait can be hours. Or again, some people are discharged home with might be a simple viral infection, but, you know, 8 hours later they return in fulminant septic shock, and the parents didn't know to bring them back. So again, we're working on improving certainly emergency department providers in explaining these things to parents and what to be mindful of. And you can literally list those things out. So, you know, if they're becoming more lethargic, if you think they're looking a bit more pale, if they're irritable, if their cry changes, all those little things that you're worried about, that could indicate that they're doing worse. And if they're doing worse or you're more concerned than usual, please let us know, come back, call us. and because they might be deteriorating, it can happen with children, something around that. But if they don't know what to look out for, you know, you can go down the community and say, oh, who's heard of it? Who's heard of a heart attack and what's a sign of a heart attack? I guarantee you 95% of the population will say, oh, chest pain. Tell them about sepsis, they won't know. And certainly speaking to parents that have lost children where their child has died from sepsis, they say, had I have known what sepsis was, I would not have come home from the GP and, you know, watch my child get sicker and sicker over the course of a day or two to then have had them die. I would have gone to the hospital straight away, and they probably would have been with us today. So big important, but really easy thing to implement into your practice.
Absolutely. And I think that comes around the whole health literacy in general. As you mentioned at the start, you know, if you say to someone, do you have any health conditions, and they say no, and then pour out all their medications, it's a bit of an indication to sort of what, I guess, general public generally will have a health literacy about. And equally, when trying to safety net around, you know, look out for signs of infection for your wound, usually people will leave it at that, and most people will be like, well, what are the signs of infection? So,
yeah, absolutely.
I think, yeah, sort of advocating for your patients and telling them what to look out for, as you said, is such a critical point. And, yeah, no, I think that's really, really important. And one of the places where I think most healthcare or any healthcare professional can make a difference. So in terms of recognizing sepsis and, you know, treating it, is there any points that you think we've missed that you'd like to convey to all of our listeners?
Oh, I can talk about this for days. I think just know it's tricky. And I think know that you may have a gut feeling about something. And depending on your years of experience, obviously this will have to evolve over the time. But if you have a gut feeling about a child that you're assessing and you literally can't find any objective signs or symptoms to validate your concerns, don't ignore that. Don't ignore that, oh no, well, everything's actually checking out all right, because you have that gut feeling and that, you know, clinical intuition, we call it, or gestalt, there's many names for it, for a reason. And it's not some, you know, magic voodoo. It's because something is a sixth sense and not sitting right, because you've probably seen it before. That's a big thing. So trust your gut with that. And again, I would encourage you to hand that over to the triage nurse as well. And children are very transient. They will look like rubbish. You'll give a little bit of treatment and suddenly they look great. So the child that the nurse is then assessing is a totally different child to what you saw, but they need to know that information. I think as well, depending on, I've said it before, that, you know, our knowledge and awareness of sepsis is not great, and that's across the board in the community, but also as health professionals. So I think as students, you guys have listened to this, I think advocate for those patients. If you're, you know, on placements or you're newly graduated, you'd be partnered with a very senior paramedic, hopefully. But don't be afraid to use your voice and empowered to speak up about people that you may be concerned about. And yes, they may not be shocked, but it may just be way too early in the trajectory of that sepsis continuum to have it declared itself. But there's subtle things that you can keep an eye on, which we've said, and trends over time as well. And the other thing is probably, be mindful of the re-presentations to health services. So again, if they're calling you and they've been to the GP, they've been to a hospital, and now they're calling you, don't again become complacent and go, oh, well, you know, honestly, they're just paranoid. Like, you know, what, you know, Munchausen or something, what is actually wrong with them? There may actually be something severely wrong that, again, has just been too early in the sepsis trajectory for it to identify themselves, but the parents know something that we don't. So listen to that, and be a red flag is that re-presentation to healthcare providers for the same illness.
That's fantastic advice. In regards to sort of increasing your own knowledge around this, where is the best evidence and best, you know, information on this that everyone can look up?
So for children, the Surviving Sepsis Campaign guidelines are really comprehensive. And there's certainly a bit of a movement towards, there's a couple of studies out there that now looking at paramedics around time to antibiotic administration, because we know with some obvious forms of sepsis, like, you know, meningococcal, that antibiotics can certainly be started on route. So there's some literature around that. But Surviving Sepsis Campaign, probably really easy to digest information, and I'm very biased in this myself, but is our paediatric sepsis website. So Queensland Paediatric Sepsis Program, we have a plethora of education resources, materials, information to raise awareness, videos on families that have had a child with sepsis, and things to look out for, which is really informative and lots of information. We've got parent leaflets, so again, that you can have a read over, and certainly pass on that information to families around what things to look out for and what changes in status to look out for. And that will be, if you just Google, you know, Queensland Paediatric Sepsis Program or Queensland Paediatric Sepsis, you should be able to get straight to that page and download those resources. And the Global Sepsis Alliance is another really good one. Lots of information from a global perspective around that and lots of resources. And the Australian Sepsis Network, certainly as well here in Australia, there is a national body that's helping coordinate a lot of this work for adults and paediatrics.
That's awesome. Well, I definitely implore everyone to go and have a look at all of those because it's such an important topic. And as you said,
just a bit of light reading.
Just a little bit. no, that's awesome. Thank you. Well, I think we've gone through a pretty good overview of everything, and hopefully it's encouraged most people, if not everyone, to go and read into it a bit more and see, you know, how they sort of fit into the picture and can help, you know, put all the pieces of the puzzle together for that patient and their family. So I do really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come on and have a chat.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me. And if you've got, there's one more thing, if you've got specific information or education or things like that, if you email pediatric sepsis at health.qld.gov.au, then we can support you with things like that.
That's awesome. Well, thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.